House Finance come to order. It's 8:44 a.m. on the 17th or the 7th of April 2014. We have members present: Representative Munoz, Representative Holmes, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Guerra Stoltz, Co-Chair Osterman, Representative Edgman, and Representative Thompson. Representative Costello is going to be delayed this morning. Representative Newman is on his way back from is out today, and Representative Wilson has a measure up, and I understand Representative Thompson may have to leave here in a half hour for another bill in another committee. We should all be so lucky to have so many active bills. And so we'll start, because you have to leave, we'll start with your bill, Representative Thompson. It's our intent to just have a presentation of the bill. We'll see if there's public testimony, and then we'll hold it for more information.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm Steve Thompson, House Representative from District 3 in Fairbanks. And in front of us today is House Bill 314. It's an act relating to the application of passenger vehicle rental tax. In 2003, the legislature passed a rental vehicle tax intended to raise money from tourists using rental cars on the state's road system. The reasoning behind this legislation was so non-Alaskans could help pay for the wear and tear that they put on our roads during the tourist season. It was initially intended that the tax, in most cases, would not affect Alaskans. However, that is not the case today. Since its passage in 2003, the statute has been amended three times, and today we are here for a fourth time. House Bill 314 amends the rental vehicle tax to make it clear that the tax should only apply to passenger recreational vehicles as defined in AS 43.52. My staff will briefly go through the changes that we've had on the bill and probably give a little brief history of it.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson. In the current O version of the bill before you, Section 1 is a housekeeping section where we consolidated two existing sections of law regarding the term passenger and recreational vehicle for better organization of the statute. Except for the tax rates, the factors are the same for both types of vehicles. Section 2 reduces the term from 90 days to 28 days for which a lessee of a rental is exempt from the tax. A lease or a rental is exempt if the rental is for 28 days or more and has a written contract. An extension of the contract is also exempt as long as the extension is agreed upon before the expiration of the initial 28-day lease or rental period. And there is no break in the initial period of rental and the period of extension. This is done in order to be more in line with the current contracts used by rental companies, and also because most people visiting Alaska and renting cars rent them for less than 28 days. Section bill, 3 of the bill is again a consolidation of the terms passenger and recreational vehicle to better organize the statute. And this section clearly states that passenger vehicles are taxed at the rate of 10% of the total fees and costs, and recreational vehicles are taxed at 3% of the total fees and costs. Section 4 is repeals AS 4352-030 and 4352-040 because they're no longer needed due to the consolidations in Section 1 and 3. Section 5 provides for immediate effective date. The O version of this bill removes two sections that were in the original version of the bill. One dealt with decreasing the gross vehicle weight, and we had looked at 8,500 pounds down to 6,500 pounds. Unfortunately, this would also grab lightweight pickup trucks and some SUVs, which are rented as passenger cars. So that created a large fiscal note. The other change in this was to go from 90 days to 28 days. The idea behind this is to better align commercial contracts, so that the problem we had was, and the reason this bill came around, was due to vehicles that were leased along with heavy equipment. so it was a business-to-business lease. A lot of them were up in the slope or in on mines where it was not actually been driven on public roads. So in taking this lease period down, we're trying to capture those vehicles that are leased between Alaska businesses doing businesses with Alaska businesses. And I think you can see that if you look through the letters of support. And that is the bill before you. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Holmes.
Thanks.
Sarah. Sarah.
One quick question you may anticipate from me. last year we dealt with tax on leased motorcycles. Does this affect that at all?
Representative Holmes, through the chair, no, it would not. We did not change that section of law. That would still apply.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jane, Representative Thompson, I like the bill. I understand the purpose of it. And it was smart, I think, to talk about passenger and recreational vehicles. I think that gets you pretty close to where you want to go. you do mention the problem that I think we should address, which is Alaska business to Alaska business rentals. You're an Alaska business. You rent so you can do work with another Alaska business. But I don't think that line 12 is – I think line 12 is sort of a not – the closest proxy to get you where you want to get. There are tourists that come up here for more than 28 days. It's here, a lot of places in the world, people come up for the summer. Rather than exempting those people from the tax, which they should be paying, I'm quite confident we come up with language that says if the rental is primarily for a business doing work with another Alaska business and not for recreation, then the tax doesn't apply or you get a refund from the Department of whoever.
Representative Guerra, through the chair, two thoughts on this. 28 days is the shortest month of the year. We align this to what would be conceivable to be a rental of a hotel room or a property, that at some point there's some sort of residency or something. And those are the terms, that would be the shortest term of a commercial lease. So that's basically how that period of time got written in there. This bill has gone through multiple iterations.
Before we even saw it.
Before it even came to you guys. And fair maybe point. If the chair would give me a little leeway, I could discuss the history through both bodies briefly.
I was going to ask you to put that on the record.
Okay.
Why we're dealing with this issue probably more explicitly.
Chairman Stoltz, if you look in your packages, there is quite a few letters. There is also a letter from BP addressing this. When the passenger tax went into effect in 2004, and I have to be a little careful about this, I will tell you there is a criminal investigation underway, that there has been executive session in the other body. I was not privy to it, and I don't want to get in the middle of that, and neither does the sponsor, you know. So there's some ethical challenges to how we approach this. Mm-hmm. That somehow these vehicles that are on not being driven on public highways that are maintained by the state are still being taxed. In 2010, it is my understanding that the Department of Revenue, and Matt Fonder's online and can probably give you better testimony on this, my understanding is they started sending letters to rental companies that were renting on the North Slope and to large-scale mines. These cars were not being driven on public roads. Of course, DOR has no way to sort this out, so it is a problem for them. It was a problem for industry because suddenly they're getting tax notices for long periods of time. I do not know, nor was I privy to know, nor do I want to know, nor does the sponsor, if there were companies that were not that collected tax and did not pay it to the state, then they have criminal problems and they should be dealt with. However, if it was assume because of the definition of highway and statute that vehicles on the north slope were not to be taxed, then I think that's the rub, is that, and did do a little looking in statute, and we do describe highway three ways. Two of them are roads that have public access and public maintenance. However, there is another definition that is in 1959-001. It is a highway includes a highway, whether included in a primary or secondary system, road, street, trail, walk, bridge, tunnel, drainage structure, or other similar or related structure or facility, and the right-of-way thereof, and further includes a ferry system, whether operated solely inside the state or to connect with a Canadian highway, and any such related facility. So I do not know, and maybe it's a question for DOR, how they interpret what a public highway is, because the passenger vehicle tax statute does read that a passenger vehicle is a motor vehicle as defined in AS 2890-990 that is driven or moved on a highway or other public right-of-way of the state. So ultimately, maybe that is the question. And it's been a really hard thing to define. So this is why we brought you what we brought you today and how we got here.
Thank you. And I only have one fiscal note that I could see. It talks about a zero fiscal note. And unless I'm misreading it.
Representative Guerra, through the chair, it is an indeterminate fiscal note in change in revenue, doing it this way. There is a minimal reduction in the vehicle rental taxes collected as a result of these changes, is how it's listed. One of the issues we had is we did have other language. We had the reduction in the size of cars. We did have some retroactive language that gave us quite a large fiscal note. Even just dealing with the weight restriction, the fiscal note was an indeterminate, but they estimated that the trucks and the SUVs that would be taken out would be 20% of rental vehicles. So we are still talking a fiscal note around $750,000 to do it that way.
Right. And just finally, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And so the way it's written, if you are a business to business, you'll still pay the rental tax for the first 28 days?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, that would be my understanding. It is also my understanding that in the other body, when asked if a vehicle rented for less than 28 days on the slope would be taxed, that the answer from DOR was yes. And that created somewhat of a rub.
Oh, just actually one final one, Mr. Chair. It seems like the moment, if you look at page 1, line 12, it seems like the moment your rental lasts more than 28 days, you get a refund for the first 28 days. It doesn't seem like you get that the state gets the tax for those 28 days. The way it's written, you're exempt if the rental is for more than 28 days. So you actually don't pay it. If it's 29 days, you don't get any of the first 28 days. Why do we do it that way?
Or Representative Garrett, through the chair, that's not what I'm reading. I'm reading that the initial lease or rental contract is for a period of 28 days or more, that it's in writing, that it's not terminated before the 28 days, and then an extension as long as it's agreed before the expiration of the 28-day rental period is also any one day to, you know, some of these vehicles go up to the slope and never leave. So, yeah, any extension over 28 days.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
I think that has to be clarified, because if you look at page 1, lines 11 through 14, and then the first line of the next page, that's a standalone provision, and it says you're exempt under A of this section, if it's for more than 28 days, the lease is in writing, and the contract's not terminated before the 28 days. So if it's for 29 days, you don't pay the first 28 days tax. And I think there has to be a provision put in there that that we don't intend for you to be waived from those first 28 days of tax. Because the way it's written, you are waived from the first 28 days of those tax.
I tend to agree with just in general with Representative Guerra on the need for clarity, because there were three of us here in this corner, right, were members that voted on this bill, and it was I think it's fair to say we all thought we were voting on the rental car tax that, as it's clearly understood, the recreational and the business rental tax, whether you're using it casually for vacation or the business traveler in or out of Alaska coming in, that was what the debate centered for on the floor. There was no deviation other than to have the amendment offered on the recreational vehicles, the RVs. I think that's my recollection. We're going back 12 years now or 11 years. But, there was no debate about this stretching into leased vehicles. It probably would have taken another direction in that debate.
It was a year before I got here. 13 years, I think.
But we voted on this.
You're right. First year of Governor Murkowski's. Yeah. Yep.
Representative Osterman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am also a little bit hesitant on this language. And I would like to hear from the department. Maybe they have better clarity as to what their intention is and how this is written.
We have Department of Revenue. I don't know if they're in Anchorage online, Mr. Fonder. So you can stay in place, Ms. Pearson. So Mr. Fonder won't be taking your seat.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
Yeah, you've been following the debate. Does anybody wish to pose a specific question to Mr. Fonder? Representative Osterman.
Yeah, just clarity on Section 2 and your interpretation of it.
Representative Osterman, through the chair, the department's interpretation of the current language is that I believe what Representative Guerra and Chairman Stoltz referred to, which is if you rent a vehicle that the initial contract is at least 28 days or more, you would be exempt from all of the tax. And I guess my understanding was that was the intention of it as following this bill throughout both bodies here. So that is the department's understanding.
Excuse me. Representative Osterman.
Thank you. Then if somebody comes to Alaska and rents a RV and has it for 30 days, does not pay any tax?
Representative Osterman, through the chair, I believe that's an accurate statement, yes.
Thank you.
And we have one little glitch to fix here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sheriff.
This is certainly a policy call, but I agree with Representative Osterman. There will be a lot of people who rent a car for tourism purposes for 30 days, if not 35 or 40. I can't tell you the percentage. You know the percentages, but if we wanted to tax just those 28 days and somebody, you know, there's a business that does this for 6 months, we can waive them for the next 5 months, easy, but, you know, you could have, you could easily have the language on line 11 after the word section would say starting on the 29th rental day, and that way you get the first 28 days of rental tax. You don't get it waived. It would be an easy fix if that's the way folks want it to go.
Whichever way we go, we want to make sure that it says what we mean and intend. I think that's Representative Thompson and then Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can understand what you're saying, but at the same time, I think this defeats the purpose of the bill from Alaska business renting to Alaska business. You've got somebody that's going to rent a piece of equipment for 90 days, then there's going to be 28 days of tax collected Is that what you're saying? And then there won't be any tax after that. It's very similar to me to most of the bed tax collected in the state. If you rent a place for over 30 days, there is no bed tax. They don't charge you for the bed tax on the first 30 days. If you're over 30 days renting, then the bed tax is waived, and this is kind of what it's modeled after. I can't see where that collecting 28 days from BP or somebody on the slope and then not collecting for the next 5 months. You know, this was the intent of the bill, was trying to clarify this for Alaska to Alaska business, basically. And so this changes the whole picture of the bill.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two things. One, I guess, I'm sorry. Jane, I think you probably went into this earlier, but in light of this conversation, and then I have a follow-up question, but could you go over again why the original bill looked like it was a 90-day and it got shortened to 28? I know you said it was to align with the shortest, you know, monthly contract, but I think you're sensing a little discomfort at the 28 days. Could you talk us through a little bit about how we got from 90 down to 28?
I think it's mostly just the fear of unintended consequences, just like we're dealing with the original bill. Ms. Pearson, sorry.
Representative Holmes, through the chair. The 28 days was a way to try to accomplish not having Alaska businesses doing businesses with other Alaska businesses. Yet, the original intent of the bill was tourism and the wear and tear it puts on our roads and tourism funding, which really had nothing to do with Alaska. The intent had nothing to do with Alaska businesses, you know, leasing cars long-term to other Alaska businesses. So that's really how we came up with that 28 days, because some businesses lease by the shortest amount of time was 28 days, the shortest month in the year. The language we tried to come up with to make this clear was taken right from the Department of Revenue's their regs. So we tried to use their regs because that seemed to be a way they understood how to approach this tax. So that's how we got to this sort of language in here. I would sincerely appreciate if the committee has a better way to do this. I think we sort of said what the problem is with the original intent, where we're trying to go. I have not found a better way to do this. The sponsor has not found a better way to do this. It's currently in the other body, in their finance committee, trying to see if there's a cleaner way to do this or die. You know, I don't know, but...
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Jim Holmes.
Yeah, no, and I'm not necessarily leaning towards going the direction we talked, where you tax the first 28 days and then you don't. I understand that, and that's not necessarily where I'm interested in going. I am a little concerned that maybe 28 days is a little too short, and so anyway, we can keep talking about that. But my other thing is just actually a drafting question, since we're working on this. You know, Section 1 is 4352.010. Section 2 is also 4352.010. But I don't see where subsection A is. I mean, Section 2 is subsections B and C. I'm looking at the underlying statute currently in the book here, and I'm looking at the statute in Section 1. Nowhere do I see what is subsection A. So it refers back to subsection A. I'm not sure. Is this language in Section 1 supposed to be subsection A, or I'm a little confused?
Representative Holmes, through the chair, that probably is a drafting error,
okay.
And that would be A.
Okay, just flagging that. Thank you. Okay. I was looking in the book for subsection A, and I couldn't find it anywhere. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, it's the nuances that we're dealing with here, and we get... I think I was in a situation where I rented something, and I needed it for 28 days, and they said... If you rent it for 31 days, you get those the next 3 days for free because you're not going to be paying a tax, so the discount rate changes. And you've been dealing with this. Is there any way around that? I mean, I can't see any. I mean, the difference between an extension of a few days versus the not having to pay any of the tax. Is there any situation where that can be... dealt with that meets the intent of the bill?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, I'm fully open to suggestions on this.
And I realize there have been scores of hours spent on this, discussing and vetting this with, as my understanding, with revenue staff and other that you didn't just plop this on committee and say, I've got an idea. That's there has been considerable vetting, and I want to get Commissioner Rodell up on the, and probably have the most definitive Department of Revenue official right at the top of the pecking order to make sure there's no ambiguity and misunderstanding. If we fix it, we want to make sure it's actually fixed. And I think that's what you're probably hearing from the committee. We're here because of unintended consequences right now. Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you tell me what the business-to-business tax collected is on an annual basis?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, the annual rental car tax is $7 million that comes into the state. One of the problems that we kept coming across is, of course, DOR has no way to know where these vehicles are in the state. So it's really hard to start bracketing things out. I mean, I don't think it's impossible to do, but it's a tax. It has to be. They have to be able to implement it. And as you can see, we've had some differences with what I think the legislative intent originally was and how this has gotten implemented through the years.
Mm-hmm.
So any suggestion you have to bring the legislative intent back to what we were trying to do, which is those passenger vehicle rental cars that that use our roads and...
Mr. Chairman, and that was my point. If you just deleted passenger and just focused on a recreational vehicle, I think you would achieve what you're trying to do or what the original intent was.
Representative Munoz, through the chair, that would actually, I think, exempt every single rental car.
Would it?
Yeah. Because they do define in this statute... in section 4352.099, which is the definition section, they do decide passenger vehicle means a motor vehicle is defined in AS 2890.990. Probably not where we really want to mess around with the definition, because 28 affects lots of things. That is driven or moved on a highway or other public right-of-way in the state. And then it goes and starts having exclusions, but does not include. And we tried to work this through an exclusion, and we could not come up with proper language for that.
All right, thank you.
And one of the things I hope we center on, whether or not it's what's the equity issue on the tax and if it's a good policy, because I don't know how many people in this whole body politic feel they have a claim on the rental tax receipts for whatever interest they have. And we sometimes, just like we did on the cruise ship tax adjustment, we spent more time debating over who got the remaining money than the policy change, and that was a very ugly debate. I'm glad we're centering on whether or not it's the tax has the intended purpose and what deleterious effect it has on business relationships and business opportunities.
Thank you, Chairman.
Representative Osterman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, my concern is basically the same. This appears to be to opening a loophole in the law that allows any recreational person who's renting motorhomes to not have to, whoever the renter is, doesn't have to pay taxes on it. All he has to do is go over 28 days. And then if he wants to extend that, all he has to do is sign an extension before the initial 28 days expire. So he could go 3 months with never paying a bit of rental tax and drive all around the state. And I know there are people who come up here and rent for more than 30 days of recreational vehicles, so I'm a little concerned that we're opening up a loophole within the law may not be a big thing, but I think it does create a...
I'm not sure the economics of spending extra several hundred dollars a day extra to save the 3%.
I know.
But
Representative Osterman, through the chair, too, I do think there may be a way to approach that if we divided out the sections again, because then we could apply it to just the passenger rental car section and keep the recreational vehicle separate. But I'd have to talk with DOR on that and see if that would be a workable solution on the recreational vehicle part.
Well, we're clearly not going to pass this bill out today, and there have been some concerns put on the table. Representative Osterman.
As a final thought, I understand the issue, and I understand what they're trying to do, but I don't read anywhere in this bill that states that we are actually trying to help Alaska businesses versus Alaska businesses rather than even an Alaskan that wants to rent a car for more than 30 days. As an individual, or so I'm not quite sure how that, you know, you're going to get there, but I do, you know, I think we need to really work on it.
The thing we want is a Carlson lawsuit on rental car taxes.
Chair, I've got one final.
We got gouged by the commercial fishermen from outside. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I can only guess that it does increase the chances of a constitutional challenge by really focusing on non-Alaskans, but I'll just leave that aside because I'm just guessing. But then I go back to the underlying purpose, which is if it's Alaska businesses dealing with Alaska businesses, and they're real Alaska businesses, most of them already have their own vehicles. And if it's focused on the oil industry, they've already gotten – we spent a lot of time debating – how much they should get in terms of breaks last year. I'm not convinced that if that's the goal, that they need another break. The state is in the red for a while, and I don't know if I'm comfortable with that either, that aspect. Thanks.
Okay, we will set this bill aside and look forward to working. No, I don't look forward to it. We're ready and willing to try to work this out.
Thank you very much.
The broader concern is actually the leasing agencies, I think, for at least from the folks I have talked to.
That's correct.
Which are the Alaskan businesses that are now in a precarious state with the uncertainty of the law and the lack of enforcement and collection in some cases. Thank you, Ms. Pearson. We'll set this bill aside. We'll announce again we're going to have another bill heard that we will not act on today, but we'll have, because the bill is on the Senate floor right now. We'll have the initial presentation, and with the assumption that's going to preclude a lot of questions when the Senate bill comes up again, but I never bet on anything. Welcome. We have Senate House Bill 376. Representative Higgins, and anybody you'd like to bring with you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Higgins from District 5. This is House Bill 376, which has to deal with the Alaska Healthcare Commission. As I've spoken with people in this building and this body, health care is a very high cost. I think everyone understands that in the state. And the importance of a health care commission, right now we're at a crossroads, and we need this commission to continually stay active. In the sponsor statement, as you can read, you know, what their jobs are, and basically the affordability and the access to health care, and to identify strategies for improving the health of all Alaskans, which is very important. And all the information we can gather for this building to help us make the decisions that we make are important. And so I'm going to, you know, I know we're not moving this bill through right now. We're going to wait for the Senate side. But I just wanted to let everyone know that the more information we get from other sources, the better informed we are so we can make our decisions. And that's how important this commission is. So I would recommend we keep it in place. This is a sunset bill. This is basically puts them through for three more years, and I think the next 3 years are going to be very important to the state. And so that's my recommendations, and I'll let Deb talk to the commission.
And we will hear her testimony, then after that we're going to go to the auditor for a perfunctory audit testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Deborah Erickson. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Healthcare Commission. And I believe we actually have Dr. Ward Hurlburt online, who's the Chief Medical Officer for the Department of Health and Social Services and the chairperson of the commission to testify. And I'm available to answer technical questions or questions about the fiscal note, but Dr. Hurlburt was going to take the lead in testifying on the bill for the department and
okay,
the commission.
If you want to defer to him, then I will bring the auditor up, and then we'll go to the it doesn't look like public testimony. It looks like involved parties testimony. Welcome, Ms. Curtis.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Chris Curtis. I represent the Division of Legislative Audit. Our agency did conduct a sunset review of the commission. The report is dated May of 2013. I believe you should have a copy of the audit in your meeting packets.
Take one in here.
The purpose of the audit is to examine whether the commission was serving the public's interest and whether its termination date should be extended. And because this is the first sunset review of the commission, we did provide some background information, and that is on page 5 of the audit report. It's a very high-level summary. The Alaska Healthcare Commission was created as a way to help reform healthcare in Alaska. It was first established by an administrative order in 2008 and then reestablished in statute in 2010. The legislature intended the commission to achieve reform through developing a statewide health plan. The original commission established in 2008 did not consider itself responsible for developing a statewide health plan. Instead, the commission focused its efforts on specific policy recommendations. When the commission was reestablished in statute in 2010, commission members agreed to continue the prior commission's work and use the same general approach. Rather than working on a state plan, the commission collected information from various cost studies and developed high-level policy recommendations. The commission also established general priorities, which evolved into a strategic framework. And that strategic framework is included in the audit report as Appendix A. Overall, this audit concluded that the commission is operating in the public's interest, but improvements in the development of a state health plan are needed to justify its continued existence. The legislature intended the commission to work together with the Department of Health and Social Services to create a comprehensive health plan. And though various policy recommendations were developed, the commission.
Maybe you can elaborate on that. The commissioner has his handpicked person heading the commission. How come it's not coordinated? Were there any? Please go on.
Chair, I believe we'll get to that.
Okay.
Though various policy recommendations were developed, the commission did not collaborate with the Department of Health and Social Services to achieve its intended outcome, and there is no state health plan. Consequently, the audit recommends only a 3-year extension, which we consider to be adequate time to develop a plan. The audit did conclude that this commission has been active. Several studies have been conducted, and the foundation for a plan has been developed. Our concern is that this foundation, or the strategic framework, lacks the actionable components necessary for effective implementation. It does not identify specific actions to be taken, the time frame for completion, the organization responsible for taking action, definition of a successful outcome, nor does it specify how progress will be monitored and measured. Without a statewide health plan, the actions of the commission may not effectively impact health care in Alaska. The audit recommends the commission coordinate with the Department of Health and Social Services commissioner to identify each agency's roles and responsibilities regarding developing a plan and pursue development accordingly. The audit also includes 2 administrative type recommendations, 1 to improve public noticing of meetings and 1 to ensure annual reports include all statutorily required elements.
You have any, does it seem a little odd to you that one of the criticisms is there's not coordination when a top HESS official is heading the commission? I know it's a big department. That's one of the criticisms. And when I read this last week, that jumped out at me.
Through the chair, I believe when you look at the department's response, you will see that they only partially concur with the audit findings. And They regard the progress that they've made to be very, very close to a plan or exhibit many elements of a plan, and we do agree there is a foundation in place, and the commission has been very active. But again, what is in place does not meet the requirements of a plan for the various reasons we've already testified on. And in order to be effectively implemented and to achieve some type of results, we believe more coordination needs to happen to achieve the legislative intent of the commission, and that was to develop a state health plan.
I imagine they've been playing a little defense, too. Maybe it'd be hard to... Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if there hasn't been a plan yet, why are we extending this 3 years versus just one, so that if a plan hasn't been developed, then, because, I mean, we're spending $500,000 a year on something that I thought we would have already had.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, this recommendation was a collaborative effort working with the commission and the department on how much time it would take to come forward with a plan. And given that these issues are very complex, and while much work has been done to create a foundation, much work still needs to be done to bring forward a plan. We did discuss various lengths, and we came to the conclusion that 3 years was adequate time for them to come forward with the plan.
Okay. I think probably these questions are going to be better answered by Dr. Hurlburt. I just had the broader question. Thank you, Ms. Erickson. Or did you have?
Yes. Within the original legislation, yeah, sure. Any of the two original legislations, first the one 2008 and then 2000, no. In 2008 legislation, was there any time frames put in there in reference to a plan?
Representative Osterman, through the chair, I do not believe so. I'm going to turn around and look to my colleague to make sure that's the case who conducted the audit. If that's – there was no time limit built into that original administrative order.
It just speaks to them giving a plan out.
Through the chair, I didn't catch that.
Legislation just speaks to them coming up with a plan?
Through the chair, legislation, we did contribute the wording of the legislation as part of the contributing factor as to why there is no plan. The way it's worded, it says the commission may coordinate with the department or should coordinate with the department, and it says the department may develop a plan. There's this legislative intent that they work together, and neither the department nor the commission disagrees that they should work together to create a plan. But the language is not strong in a definitive sense to require it. Although, again, it is the reason the commission, it is their responsibility. It's the reason they were created.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Curtis. Thank you, Ms. Curtis. Mr. Hurlburt, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am. Thank you.
Okay. Please identify yourself for the record and give your brief testimony, and we'll probably have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ward Hurlburt. I'm the chair of the Alaska Healthcare Commission and the chief medical officer for the Department of Health and Social Services. I'd like to also express my appreciation to Representative Higgins for his words of confidence and for the audit process, which we found to be very constructive in the way it was carried out. The Healthcare Commission, to answer the questions that were just raised initially, the Healthcare Commission did not read our charge in the legislation as mandating a plan, and quite frankly, my own bias has been that health plans often become a document that sits on a shelf. And so we have focused for the past 5 years of recommendations on some clear and specific recommendations, but with the legislative audit process, we took their findings and clarification very seriously and have been working closely with the commissioner in taking the recommendations and the findings that we have and proceeding to develop a plan with the intent to do everything that, that we can to assure that it is not just a document that takes up space on a shelf, but is something that will benefit the state of Alaska. My own bias is that the Health Care Commission has been clear, but again, has been valuable to the governor's office, to the legislature, but I believe that Representative Higgins' words are more significant than mine, and I believe I'm absolutely committed that the legislature needs to make the determination about extending it based on our value to you. I want to start out with just a little bit of context. You folks in the legislature, your committee specifically and others, are dealing with financial issues, particularly acute this year, with our reduced throughput. And one of the big issues is the funding for school districts, where Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and others. Over the last 15 years or so, salaries for teachers in the Anchorage School District have increased on the average of 1% a year above the rate of inflation. The cost for medical care coverage for Anchorage School District employees over that same period has increased about 15% a year above inflation. So I would say that the reason we, as a state, that the legislature, that this committee is having a real financial challenge is largely because of the increase in medical care costs that the Anchorage School District has experienced. Now, the U.S. spends about 18% of our GDP on health care, Alaska about 20 or 21%. Other industrialized countries spend between 9 and 12%, and comparable ratios of dollar equivalents. If the U.S. had spent the same amount over the last 20 years that Norway or Switzerland did, the two next most expensive countries, we would have saved about $15 trillion, $15 trillion, almost our total federal national debt. The only state that spends more than Alaska per person is Massachusetts, and they have an older population. 97% of Massachusetts residents are insured through the Romney Care program, and they have more physicians per 1,000 population than any other state. We're about mid-range among the states in terms of physician staffing. But studies done in Massachusetts have revealed the main reason that their costs are more expensive than anybody else has been the rapid escalation in their pricing. And the Milliman study, which was one of the studies the Health Care Commission obtained, showed that the main reason that pricing and the percent of our state's gross domestic product are higher than other states in the comparison states has been pricing here. The members of the Health Care Commission represent physicians, hospitals, nursing homes, behavioral health insurers, tribal health system, federal health care, community clinics, the public, the legislature, and the administration. The members have done an admirable job both of representing and bringing their own knowledge to the commission, but clearly taking the position that they're representing all Alaskans and representing the legislature and the governor's office in looking at the issues that we wrestle with. British Columbia, under the Canadian system, with their 4.8 million citizens, if they spent what the U.S. spends for health care for that population, would have spent about $25 billion more than they did. And when I asked my counterpart in B.C., what do you do with that money, he's a government employee, he said, well, roads, education, and so on. But it does indicate that we are forced to make choices by what we spend. Now, we are clearly not looking for a Canadian solution, a Norwegian solution, a British solution, but an American market-based solution. What have we done? So far, we've gathered information and analyses related to the provision of health care. These are all available on the website for the Health Care Commission. We've gathered information from other states and have had experts visit, looking at some of the things that are being done elsewhere. We have provided a set of recommendations each year in January to the legislature and to the governor's office. We've collaborated with other groups, such as Commonwealth North and the group of HR directors for many of the larger employers here, reaching out to the business community. In regard to state government, we have had a thrust in two areas. One is to identify areas where there are regulations or laws in Alaska that mitigate against a free marketplace. in the negotiations between providers and payers. And secondly, in looking at the state as a purchaser, the state purchases about $2.6 billion a year of health care for Medicaid enrollees, for employees, for retirees, for their dependents, for the Department of Corrections, and so on. The state is a big purchaser, and there historically has been relatively little coordination from what we found, but the Department of Administration, the Workers' Comp Program, Medicaid, and others have been very open, and there's been much increased communication and collaboration. The state, as a purchaser, as opposed to being a regulator, the state as a purchaser has a lot of potential leverage, both to affect the whole market and what the state does. Finally, to be brief on this, the work of the Healthcare Commission has been engaged in within the context that we need and want a robust healthcare sector in Alaska. We've been sensitive to recognizing that the committed people in our healthcare sector, that we don't say things in any context that would demonize them because they are good people and they're valuable to all Alaskans. We recognize that certain important perspectives are in our finding. One, that pricing for healthcare in Alaska is often unreasonably high, and that correction of this unsustainable reality will not come without some tension and some disagreement. Two, we've consistently taken the viewpoint that while healthcare is indeed a business, and a very large business, that there are unique ethical and moral dimensions that are unique to this industry. And three, because of this unique characteristic over the long run, the leadership needed for change will best come from those within the industry, from physicians, from hospital administrators, from nurses, pharmacists, and others. So with the efforts of the Healthcare Commission to bring greater transparency in what's available there and bring the information about the realities of our healthcare system here and information about what other states may be doing, we believe that this will help pave the path to get that kind of leadership. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'll be happy to respond to any questions, Mr. Chairman.
And Dr. Hurlburt, over the last couple of years on the commission, what would you characterize your workload? Is it proactive activities toward trying to create efficiencies, or is it reactive to external policies from other political jurisdictions? And if you could talk about your apportionment of your workload and the stress points of trying to deal with your committee's work and your goals.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The committee, as it was initially established by Governor Palin, was a little smaller, and then when it was established in law by the legislature, was expanded, and so there was a change in membership there, and there has been some change because it is a time commitment. So partly due to that, partly because it was new, partly because it's a group of people from mostly from healthcare industry, but others, there has been a lot of time spent in educating both the members of the commission and the public. So there's been a lot of effort spent on gathering information, on getting analyses of the reality of what we have here in Alaska, and bringing in experts. And that's been a significant chunk of the mission. And the activity, and that's clearly not done. That would clearly continue, probably indefinitely. But there has been a change in effort and focus to reaching out, identifying other entities that have an interest and concern in this area, reaching out to them, collaborating with them, helping them collaborate with each other. The function that I think will continue to grow will be serving as a convener of the various portions of our Alaska society that have concerns and interest in that. And then we have earlier on where we have had each year some fairly specific findings and recommendations. We were careful not to to assign responsibilities on this, feeling that was not the commission's role, although, again, in response to some of the earlier comments, all along, Deb and I have both worked very closely and collaboratively with the commissioner and kept the communication going there. But with the recommendations and findings of the legislative audit process, I think you would see in this year's recommendations, we have responded to that, certainly embraced it, and become more specific. So I would see going forward doing more of that. Does that respond, Mr. Chairman?
I think you totally left off any discussion of any federal policies or mandates you're dealing with. I think that was the crux of my question.
Okay.
And what part of your activity is that and is dealing with a with an evolving national policy that affects Alaska? What part of that workload is this, and what challenges that face that cause you?
Okay.
Does that cause you to be more reactive than proactive?
Yes, that's correct. With the large federal sector here, we have had the past two basic medical group commanders from JBEAR on the commission. Colonel Tom Harrell just left. We also have the tribal health system on there, so there's been engagement. But as far as the Affordability Care Act, the commission has, for each of our meetings, had an update of what's happening with the Act, but has not assumed a proactive role as far as should we participate in a state operated exchange or the federal exchange as we've elected to do, should we expand Medicaid as we have elected along with half of the other states elected not to do. So the commission has kept itself informed on that, partly because of the political sensitivities, partly because we didn't see that we were the best forum to do that. We have not been proactive regarding the Affordability Care Act.
So would you characterize it maybe a cautious defensive posture?
I think that's fair, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Guttenberg and then Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Hurlburt. I know we had you here earlier in the year, and we're all delighted at the work that you're doing. But you mentioned the difference between recommendations and policy, and concern that recommendations is just a report that gets put on the shelf. And I'm concerned that both things get put on the shelf. But really what I think I want to see you doing, and looking at all the conveners and everybody that's involved in it, I'm not sure you could actually ever do anything without proactive to increase the health care delivery to the people of Alaska as far as quality and affordability without somebody getting ouched, you know, because if we're talking about affordability, then we're talking about efficiencies and talking about somebody's profit someplace. And when you talk about delivering a higher quality, somebody's going to have to be pointed out that they're not delivering a higher quality. So what I'm actually been hoping that comes out of this commission is definitive ideas and statements and places where there's roadblocks to competition or efficiencies. You know, when I talk with various people in this industry, you know, they're always very circumspect, but something has to happen, and if you can make it happen, I would like to hear about it, or this body would like to hear about it. What is it that's in the way that's stopping the delivery of quality, affordable health care? And that, you know, throw that in front of us and let people act.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I believe that the recommendations, I would share your concern that if they just end up on a shelf, then we should have saved the $500,000 a year. But I think we do see some things happening, and I think that you're absolutely right that there's a lot of money involved here. There's a lot of deeply felt feelings, and that there will be some tension on this. There have been some specific recommendations. One, for example, for greater transparency. And one of the ways this has been done in a number of states is to have what's called an all-payer claims database. This has been recommended as one of the specific recommendations of the Healthcare Commission. Representative Newman has actually championed this concept within this body. And what that does, it's a requirement that payers need to report what they are paying for services, so that becomes available to other payers, like business owners, like individual patients. There was a bill introduced in Washington State recently, and the opponents of that were Premera and Regions, the two largest health insurance companies there, and they were able to stop it there, and they ended up with a bill that the governor signed where just where the state is a payer, both for Medicaid and for employees and retirees, would be published, and it was a step forward. But there was a real conflict there. Now, Jeff Davis, who has been the CEO for Premera here, has been just an extremely valuable member of the Healthcare Commission, has continued to represent the whole state, and Jeff has so much to offer and has given so much to help our state, but clearly his corporate bosses, if we had a bill introduced here, his corporate bosses might say, Premera Alaska, you need to oppose it. Through our Milliman studies, we have identified the very high profit margins for hospitals, particularly in the urban areas in Anchorage, and this does not make their leadership comfortable. But we have had absolutely outstanding people leading those institutions, and they will, that's the American way, they will want to continue to maintain their level of profitability, but there's discomfort there, and that transparency has been there. There are some regulatory and legal restrictions in the state. For example, the requirement under workers' compensation that the payments be made at 90th percentile of the market pricing, which means if you have a specialty where there are relatively few providers and you control more than 10% of the market, you can control that pricing. And Representative Olson has introduced a bill during this session, which is still being considered, to base that pricing for workers' comp, where we pay more than any other state and a higher percentage for medical care than any other state, to base it on a cost-based methodology rather than the provider's pricing. Now, all of those things are quite controversial. It's not that there are bad people on one side of that issue and good people on the other. There are good people on both sides, but it does reflect a change. It deals with money. It's very sensitive. It deals with a very important industry. But I think those are just some examples of some concrete things that have come so far from the Healthcare Commission.
Thank you. Can I a follow-up question? And do some gouging here. But we hear a lot of concerns from providers about Medicaid reimbursement rates, that they're inadequate and their businesses are having a hard time functioning at that practices at that level of reimbursement. How accurate is that? How accurate have you found that to be at the end of the day, or is that just something that providers want what they're charging, and anything less is not something that's acceptable to them, regardless of whether it covers the cost?
The payment methodologies that Medicare uses, and it's possible you may be referring to Medicare, but that both Medicare and Medicaid use are cost-based. Based on the cost of the practice, based on malpractice costs, staffing costs, training costs, all those various things. Outside Alaska, the Medicaid payment levels are much lower. I haven't made the recent comparison, but when I moved back here about 5 years ago, the Medicaid payment levels in Washington State were about 40% of what they were in Alaska. We were about 2.5 times higher. And in talking with my friends in the industry, like a hospital administrator, whom I have a great respect for, the understanding I have from them is that Medicare is the bigger problem, because unlike 48 other states, the Medicare payments are lower. Most places, Medicare is higher than Medicaid. In Alaska, Medicaid is higher than Medicare. So they feel the greatest threat has come from the Medicare payments. But I would say any place that I've lived or worked, the Medicare and Medicaid payments, based on a cost-based analysis, are significantly lower than what commercial insurance pays, and the providers are not happy with that and complain about that. And words are often used, well, it's going to drive me out of business. I think that to the number of times that's actually happened, I don't know. I'm not aware that it's happened a lot.
Just a follow-up, just a clarification, Mr. Chair. So is there a study dealing with the actual cost of delivering a service against what the reimbursement rates are? I don't care what the insurance pays, because they're making profits either way. But, you know, what does it actually cost to deliver an X-ray or an office visit, and what is the reimbursement rates, and what is the relationship with them?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, that's exactly what the Medicare reimbursement methodology is. It looks at all of those kinds of costs and brings in the other things that I mentioned, like malpractice costs, the cost of the physicians being trained, to the expertise that they have. It looks at those costs. It includes costs on the hospital side, for example, for facility costs, for the need for reimbursement and capital expense there. And that methodology, which really is owned by the American Medical Association, so it's not just something that big government does, but it comes from the provider side of the equation. That's designed to get at those costs and to set a reimbursement rate for that. There is talk around the country of getting more to reimbursement rates that are related to that, but for the most part, outside of government payers, what's charged is like any other business, and it's a balance of what the traffic will bear and what you charge to still get business through the door.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Hurlburt. Two questions. One is it true that, we understand we have the highest medical costs in the country, or second highest medical costs in the country, but the second concerning one is that annually we have the highest or second highest increases in medical costs every year. So not only are they high, but every year they go up more than any other state. Is that accurate, and why do you think that is?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I think it relates to my last statement. There's in any business, whether it's McDonald's selling Big Macs or a neurosurgeon doing surgery on your head, there is a human tendency in business to charge what you can. Our competition is limited here. We have a history of very high costs, and it's not easy for people to walk with their feet. Certainly one of the potential competitive items, and in talking with Jeff Davis in their TPA business, where the employers are at risk and Premera manages those contracts, he's actually seeing more pressure from employers to look to send patients to Seattle or Portland or Salt Lake City or somewhere else for services, because the costs are so much less. But that's not easy to do, and it does shelter things here. And I think on every Alaskan, there's the realization and the commitment that we want a robust, high-quality healthcare sector here. Some things will be better done outside. If you have a real bad burn, you don't want to be here at the Alaska Native Medical Center or Providence or anywhere else. you want to go to Harborview or a similar burn center. But where things are appropriately done for our 750,000 people, we would like, to the extent that we can, to have it done here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We will have Senate Bill 135 before us fairly soon, so hopefully people have we always have the opportunity to ask questions. Hopefully people have played out a lot of their questions, but certainly anticipate new ones coming up. But
Chair, what is Senate Bill? What is the Senate bill you just referred to?
It is an exact companion of this bill, and it's on the House floor, voted on Friday, and up for reconsideration today. So
got it.
I'm guessing that no matter how fast we acted, that bill will get here first. So we did. We will, as required, we will have public testimony and questions again. That was our intent, to try to clear out some of the questions on the exact same bill ahead of time. So, but that will set it aside out of necessity, and we will, unless you have anything else, Mr. Co-Chair, we will adjourn, and we'll see the House floor schedule to dictate whether we come back here this afternoon. Well, with that, we're standing adjournment.